Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artists First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning into the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. This show airs at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Monday. For more information about this show and listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/maxinethompson.htm. And don't forget to follow Artist First on Twitter. You can find us under the Twitter handle at @artist_first. And now, your host, Dr. Maxine Thompson, but I am going to be interviewing Dr. Maxine Thompson tonight. I'm sure all you listeners know a lot about Maxine. You keep up with her on her shows, and you know she's a great woman and a very talented writer. But I'm going to be interviewing her tonight, and she's with me now. Maxine, hey, are you there?
Yes.
All right, it's good to hear from you. How are you doing? It's been a while.
Yes, you've been out of town. I've been fine. How have you been, Corey?
I've been real good. I got my batteries charged up, and I'm ready to go.
Okay, great.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, I got a list of questions for you here. You know, we only have an hour, so let's jump into it. this is about your new book, L.A. Blues, correct? Or it might not be new. I've heard you talk about it before.
Well, it came out in July of 2011, and I have a new book that'll be coming out May 29th, 2012. That's the sequel to L.A. Blues.
Okay.
And I hope to build a series on this particular character. But L.A. Blues is about Z, who grew up in foster care. And so let me read the back cover to give a little backdrop on her.
All right.
Okay, L.A. Blues. Growing up in foster care, Zipporah Z. Saldano never dreamed of becoming a police officer. But after she's rescued from a hostage situation during the L.A. riots, she chooses a career in law enforcement. After 10 good years on the force, Z is involved in a domestic homicide case gone awry. Her partner is killed, and Z is fired when alcohol is detected in her system. It's 2 long years before she gets sober and opens her own private investigation firm. Now, Shirley, her former foster mother, is in need of Z's help. Someone has murdered her grandson, a high school basketball star, and she wants Z to find out who did it. Z soon finds herself in deeper trouble than when she was kicked out of the LAPD. What she discovers is a conspiracy much deeper than anyone would believe, and she finds her own life is in danger. So that is the back cover of L.A. Blues, but one of the topics that I wanted to discuss our gang, so you could go ahead with your questions.
Okay. Our first question we have here reads, why are gangs in America so explosive?
Well, you know, gangs have been around probably since the 50s, and maybe they had different names before they became gangs. But
right.
Looking at the crime in America .net, they say that there's 774,000 gang members and 27,900 gangs active in the U.S.
Wow.
And I guess that's the members and then the gangs itself. But this is a couple of years ago, so you can only assume that number has gone up. And I think that it's explosive because of the way the family system has changed a lot to single parents. A lot of males gravitate towards gangs when they don't have a father in the home. The gangs become their father.
Right.
And they like having that family. They become their family. A lot of times the older gang members, as they call them, OGs, you know, school them, buy them clothes, set them up selling drugs. And then as I did my research, I even found that for the different people who came from different countries, El Salvador and like that, their gangs started out as just protective units, particularly here in L.A. They were generally just kind of banding together because they were immigrants. Often they were undocumented. And because they were afraid, they start, you know, helping each other protect themselves from the Latino gangs. Even though they were, you know, from South America, they were still different. And then from the black gangs and the Asian gangs. And eventually, they developed into their own different sets and their own crews where they start collecting money from the people in their area, you know, for them to do business. They had to pay the gangs. And it became almost, it went from being just a thing of, like the gangs in the 50s used to fight with their fists, it became, after they started using weapons and the drugs entered the pictures in the late 70s and 80s, it became a business type of thing. Everybody, it's more financial situation. It's not just about the turf anymore.
Okay. And you said that that we assume that the number has grown as far as gangs go. Do you think that pop culture has something to do with that? Because, I mean, a lot of it's glorified nowadays with the music and movies and, you know, the internet. Kids have a lot more access to things that kind of tell about and, like I said, glorify gangs and things of gang nature. Do you think that the growth in gangs has to do with anything to do with pop culture?
Oh, definitely. When they see, you have a lot of kids who come from the suburbs, but when they see all this glorification on the videos of the gangs, a lot of them begin to emulate it, want to wear their pants sagging, they want to do some crime. They don't realize how crime has such a long-reaching effect. Now, some kids can get in some trouble and they get a slap on the hand, particularly when they're Caucasian, but a lot of young black men are still in prison. As you see, they're letting a lot of them out now because of the DNA for foolish things they did in their teens. But the gangs are definitely seen as something hip and something really a good thing to be in. And a lot of kids are pressured to be in gangs. If they live in certain areas, you can't help where you're born. They're kind of, you get kind of recruited to be a gang member, and then some don't get into the gangs, but they're afraid, and so they, the ones who aren't in the gang, sometimes they're targeted, and so it's really hard for children that are raised in gang territories to not be in the gangs. And one of the things I deal with in L.A. Blues is the warfare, and it's still kind of ongoing between the Latino gangs and African-American gangs. It's been, and a lot of that has been over the drug traffic. You know, there's not enough drugs going into L.A. as it used to be since they cracked down on the border. And there's been a lot of fighting among the gangs. You know, it's the, then there's the ethnic cleansing where, you know, certain Hispanic groups wanted to have one area. And there were, when I wrote this book, there were several murders that took place of young people that were definitely, you know, not just gang-related, but racially inspired. And so that was what I was kind of writing, trying to capture some of that.
Okay, it's a shame that kids have to join gangs for, the, you know, that sense of brotherhood. Too bad they don't, you know, join a baseball team or something. It just, it's a shame that they, that it you know, they spend their time and efforts in a gang. But I don't know, I guess, you know, can't win them all. So let's move on to the next question here. How has the prison system contributed to the foster care system?
Well, when parents are incarcerated, and if there are no family members available to take the children, they end up going into foster care. And that has grown over the years. You know, I've seen different statistics. Just for L.A., it was like 50,000 African-American children in the system. It might even be more. But I know that was in 1997, and the more recent ones I saw, the numbers were, had gone up some, and the same for, and then the next highest number were for Hispanic children, then the next highest was were for the Caucasian children. But it's, you know, when parents end up in prison, a lot of times their kids go into foster care. And so this, if you look at it, these are all these systems that are being paid for through the government. And the government gets the money from the taxes. I mean, there's a court system that has to be paid, the lawyers, the judges. In the foster care system, there are social workers. There are the, you know, the different court attorneys for the kids and for the parents. It's a real big business, and it doesn't do anything to promote family reunification. You know, it's like a catch-22. A few years ago, the push was for adoption for older children, and they even had grandparents adopting their grandchildren. But then it'll go, then the pendulum will swing back, and they'll say it's children should go back home to their parents. So, you know, you just never know if it's going to be a family reunification push or long-term care, which is adoption, legal guardianship, or long-term foster care. And a lot of the children in foster care end up with depression. I use Z as an example of children who have grown up in the system. There's a sense of unrootedness. You can be moved. She was in a good foster home, but it's kind of, it's such a, where the child feels alienated. And a lot of the kids that go into the system do not get to finish college. Now, there's more of a push now to put kids in college if they can. But a lot of the kids, after 18, they were put on their own. So they're trying to, you know, have funds so the children can still be in a group home and have some type of support until they're 21. Because who's ready to be on their own at 18? And so you end up with girls having babies just to get a check for that. You end up with the young men committing crime and ending up in the system. So it's like they just graduated from the foster care system to the prison system. So it's like one hand is washing the other, and is, you know, something needs to be done.
Right, and I mean, this dawned on me when you were talking about this. There, you know, with a lot of gang members being in jail, and you know, you hear a lot about the negativity in gangs and stuff. People may assume that gangs are, aren't ran very systematically, but it's true that that gangs, a lot of gangs, are very organized and very systematic. Is that true?
Oh yes, as I read up on them and study the different ones, you know, they have the cell phone system. They're beginning to do white collar crimes from the different jails. I don't want to call the names of the different gangs that moved to different states. They're able to reach out and touch people from prison. They run a drug operation through the prison system, and it, you know, these. It's just as much crime going on in the prison system from the gangs, and they're very organized in terms of they look out. You know, and they do have their code of ethics and their code of honor. They say there's no honor among thieves, but in certain ways, I know when I used to work and go out in gang territory, there was never anyone who assaulted me, anything. They were helpful, polite. They were always nice to civilians. I believe a lot of the killings go among themselves, you know, over warring factions. Okay, somebody killed your brother in this gang, and this other gang just crossed the street. Then you go and do a retaliation killing. But a lot of it, I think, now is more tied into not just that type of killing, but drug, you know, over drug money.
Right, and we touched on the prison and foster care system, how they correlate before, but I have another question about it. How have drugs in America contributed to the foster care and prison system? So how have drugs in America contributed to foster care and the prison system?
Well, I can speak from experience. When I began doing social work in 1974, all of my cases were either dirty homes, neglect, physical abuse, and there were no drug-related cases, and that was in Detroit. And when I moved to L.A., somewhere in around 83, 84, they began to have PCP babies, PCP and crack babies. You know, that's when those drugs hit the street. And it really related to, from that stem, sexual abuse, neglect, physical abuse, abandonment, you know, lack of care for children. And so I can see how that led to more children going into the foster care system. I talked to a lot of mothers who had daughters who never gave them a day of trouble, and they got hooked on the crack when they were in their 20s. I've seen people who were secretaries, who were administrative assistants, people who had companies, and they derailed their whole company for drugs. This has affected how many kids went into the system, and how many people went to prison. So as you see, those two kind of work hand in hand, too. When you have a lot of people in prison, then their children end up in foster care. And when the drugs are the reason that, I mean, even though you might see it as far as, yes, they took drugs, but they take care of their kids. But basically, when you're doing drugs, some people slip under the wire. I know some people, some family members who did it and never got, the children weren't taken, but there were still scars. But for the most part, a lot of these children did come to the attention of Children's Services and end up in the foster care system. And a lot of the people who use drugs went to jail for either pandering, prostitution, you know, robbery, armed robbery. I mean, desperate people do desperate things.
Right, and you mentioned earlier about how gangs were pretty territorial, how they would, you know, cross the line and they would get beat up over just, you know, being in someone else's territory. Why is it that, I mean, if, you know, if one gang member were to cross into another's territory and he wasn't doing anything, maybe he had family over there or something or whatever, why is it that they're so territorial when it comes to other gang members? I mean, I understand there's a... You know, there might be underlying problems or there might be conflicts in business. But, I mean, why is it that they're just so territorial? And you can, I mean, you can get, you know, shot for just being in someone else's, quote unquote, hood.
Here in L.A. is really bad. Some people have never even seen the ocean. If they were born on Grape Street, which is in Watts, they haven't even left that area, and they love it. You know, you can Google it, and they just as happy. They're doing the Crip Walk, or whatever. If you're blood, you wear the red. They're, you know, now the color sign is explicit, but if you're in the wrong, they know when you're not supposed to be in their area. And it seemed like the biggest target, but I've seen some women get killed, too, if they're in the wrong places. Several women I've seen get shot that they bought cars that belonged to former drug dealers, and they were driving them and they got gunned down. But basically it's the men. It seems like they can be a walking target if they go in the wrong area, and it's sometimes it's no reason, no rhyme for it, but it's just that this group of people banded together on this side of the street and then that side, they're, you know, they're claiming this, and then it's different factions of the Crips, which started out right after the Black Panthers. That was like they became the offspring when the Black Panthers was disbanded, then the Crips started, and that stood for Community Revolution and Progress. And I don't know if the original intent was to do something for the community, but as time went by, it became more, you know, a drug type of ran program, and it's just has had such a bad effect on so many generations. There are just too many mothers who've had to bury their children here in L.A.,
right,
before their time. And a lot of these kids were not gang affiliated. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Now, color is, I mean, as far as like what you wear or what you represent, color is a big part of gang culture. I mean, it should, like, coming into L.A., you said gang, you know, gang life was big there. Like, if a tourist came and, you know, was wearing his, you know, red shirt, into Crip territory, which is blue, I mean, would he have to worry? If he was just some, like, old guy who didn't know about, you know, gangs and their colors, like, what's the deal with colors and people who aren't in gangs, you know what I'm saying?
Well, Eddie Griffin, I think that's the comedian I heard. When he came to L.A., he was wearing red, he was in the wrong territory, but he was... And they asked him, they said, what are you doing up in here wearing this red, this blood? You want to get dead? So you really have to kind of know, because L.A. is insidious. It's beautiful. I mean, we see the Academy Awards, which I opened my new book with that, to show that contrast to that. You can think that you're in safety, but you could be in a world of trouble if you just turn up the wrong street. L.A. Right. has the palm trees. This is the beautiful city, the beautiful people. But while people are sitting at the awards, you know, the Academy Awards, people are being murdered right at that time. And you don't know. I mean, there is so much going on at L.A. always with undercover police who know the streets, who can be. That was kind of one of my premises. You know, we saw a lot of it in Training Day, that when do you cross the line? When you become an undercover police, and for you to get in with the people, you have to smoke the drugs, do the drugs. There's a lot of things that it's really is shady, and as I call it, where you draw the line between good and bad, good and evil. When do you say that I've gone too far if you're working as an undercover cop? And that was, you know, Z wasn't one, but that becomes one of the subplots in her story.
So that's a real thing. Like there are undercover cops who, to show that, you know, that they appear as a gang member and that they're loyal and that they're true to their word. If they're offered like some crack or something, they'd have to smoke it.
Yes, and I had one writer, he's a local writer, his book is called Gangsters on Both Sides of the Law. I just happened to run across it, and his name is Papa Sock, and he writes about the L.A. streets a lot, too. And, you know, I just think that L.A. is such a conglomeration of differences and contradictions. You know, you have so many races of people here and so many communities, and everyone's trying to protect their own little niche, and you know, and like I say, the gangs have their place. A lot of them, the police, you know, they've had to crash units supposedly to get rid of the gangs, but that didn't seem to work. It seemed like there's still as many gangs, even when people go to prison and get killed and shot, it's still another gang member coming up right behind them, because it's a whole philosophy that, you know, as I was writing book two, I got a little deeper into it. Young boys are trained like soldiers. Think of those boys that were soldiers, children soldiers over in Africa that were murderers and were trained to murder. Well, that's how they think it's great to be a Crip. They say, my daddy was a Crip, and they think it's great to go to prison, too. That's almost like getting street.
Wow.
Go to prison.
Huh. Wow. I have a couple more questions about the foster care here. What has happened to the first and sometimes second generation of children raised in foster care systems?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of those children have been destroyed indirectly by the system they either became. You know, they ended up having their children taken and put in foster care. A lot of them ended up in prison on drugs. You know, there's a low level of depression in a lot of the children, a sense of unrootedness and a lack of attachment. And some have beat the odds and have, you know, risen above being a foster child, but you know, there is a lot of anger, I believe, and denial, a lot of things that a lot of children haven't been able to overcome, and so we're seeing the cycle repeat itself with other children, with them having children that end up in foster care.
Now, is it because of the parents don't want them because they have gang relations going on, or is it because they're being taken by child services that they're in foster care? What's the main reason that these kids are ending up in foster care, especially generation after generation?
A lot of times it's related to the system. They don't have time. We used to always say it takes more skill to work with the family to keep them together than to take the children. I used to see people who had no understanding of the culture would go out there, and if they saw one little thing, they'd grab all the kids and take them and put them in foster care, not knowing that they'd be setting up an even worse situation. And I just really think better trained social workers who could work with families. Now, if it's a case of there are no parents around, or when parents end up incarcerated and there's no grandmothers, no aunts or uncles that could take the children, then I could see it happening, but it really doesn't work out as good for children when sometimes they go into the system. You know, when it's gangs going on, sometimes they still manage to provide, as they call it, the minimum standard of care for their children, but sometimes they don't. And in that case, you know, maybe the child got shot or just anything that was inappropriate. Can be that they got him, they overdosed on something themselves, or just the things that might would happen if you live in that type of lifestyle to your child. Then they can end up in the system that way. But it's really one of those things that I think that if they really, now they're beginning to have a few gang members that are coming back, working with gang members, trying to get them out of the gangs. And I think I've seen where they're giving jobs to people who have been to prison that were in gangs, you know, trying to help the recidivism rate, turn them around. So I think that's a start in the right direction to re-educate the community, the people who've been raised in gangs, because if you were raised in a gang, your parents were gang members, and your grandparents, how do you break that cycle?
Right. And Now, if like child services or something were to take a child from a parent who was a gang member, but later that parent realized that the gang life wasn't for them, or it was time for them to get out of, being in a gang and being affiliated with gangs, how do they prove to, you know, these foster care systems or the police or child care services, whoever it is, that they're done with the gang, they're out of it, they just want to have a normal life, want to have a family, and they want their kids back? Is that even possible?
Yes. I've seen a lot of families reunified, and one of the things they have to do is go to parenting, test clean, you know, do regular visits, establish a suitable home. No, and generally they have to move out of the area, because how can you stay in the same area and not be involved in gangs? And, you know, it's really almost a whole life reinvention they have to do to be able to get their children back. Because I don't think it's the gangs in and of itself that cause them to lose their children. It's all the other things that the gang involves. You know, when they're trying to be loyal to the gang, sometimes people are not the victim, are not the perpetrator, but if they're with a gang member that commits a crime, and it's that code of loyalty that you don't tell on the other person, then you go to jail. I think a lot of kids end up in the system because of just the other things of the gangs that go on, too.
Okay. Well, why does it work out better when children stay in the family versus getting separated into different foster homes?
Well, in my story, Z doesn't know where her younger two siblings are. They were in two different foster homes, and at the end of this book and at the end of the next book, she still hasn't relocated them. And so that's a sense of separation and detachment from her family. So I just think sometimes when they're in the family, when they're with their family, you can at least know where your siblings are.
Okay. And is there an interracial love element in the story? I know with a lot of gangs, there, some gangs are race versus race. Some gangs are interracial in themselves. But is there a good part in this story? Is there an interracial love element in this story? And what do you think it is?
Yes, it's Z, and it's how she met Romero, he becomes a love interest. And I was thinking of Romeo and Juliet, how they came from two warring families, and that's what happened with Z and her with Romero. Could I read the part of the prologue?
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Okay. It's April 29th. 1992, the L.A. riots, East Los Angeles, California. This is the character, Zipra, also known as Z. "Give me your money, mamacita." The punk had a cobra tattoo coiled on his right bicep, peeking out from under his sleeveless leather vest. He poked his gun, gangster style, directly in my face. Apparently, he was the spokesman for this group of gangbangers who surrounded me. His wool cap slid down close to his rust-colored eyes, and his scowl was threatening. I was shook, but I tried to appear composed. "I beg your pardon," I asked, stalling for time. "You heard me. Did I stutter? Don't scream, or I'll shoot you." The middle one, who was of medium height and sported a menacing bald head with a tattoo on his neck, leaned in, and a vicious sneer curled on his lips. My pounding heart echoed in my ears, and a gush of peace streamed down my legs. Why didn't I see this coming? Generally, I had intuition when it came to danger. My stomach quivered, and I clutched my Sloss and Swap Meat Gucci knockoff purse to my chest to try to calm my galloping heart. I tell you, L.A. sucks. If it weren't for his sinister words, I would have sworn dude's mellifluous Hispanic accent sounded like a song. However, this was no love song. This was a siren of danger. The group of predators, who, judging by their smooth faces, could have been anywhere from ages 13 to 19, meant business. See, this is what I'm talking about. Can't go nowhere, can't have nothing in L.A. Can't even be nowhere without some S going down. This place ain't nothing but a bunch of wannabe gangbangers who think they own imaginary turf that really belongs to the city. I don't care what the TV says about Hollywood and the beautiful people living here. In my world, it was different. I can't believe I was being jacked right here in broad daylight on Cesar E. Chavez Avenue. I thought if I worked in a different neighborhood, if I got away from Watts or Compton, I could escape the Grape Street Crips or the Piru Bloods. I wouldn't have to worry about if I wore red or blue. I wouldn't have to worry about no stupid vendetta against my brother, ma'am, a born and bred Crip. But I guess I thought wrong. What do you mean? What are you talking about? I decided to play dumb. My heart's palpitations almost drowned out my words. Don't make us have to kill you, the baby of the group snarled, his voice cracking. He was so young. Mommy, we seen you go in there and cash your little check. I didn't respond as my heart sank. Please, God, don't let me die. And then I'm going to skip down. Did you hear me? The medium-height one held up his right hand, then rubbed his thumb and forefinger together, pointing to my purse. Look, we don't want to hurt you, but give us that dinero, Mommy. As frightened as I was, I still kept on my game face. I don't got no money. I spoke in the vernacular I was used to before. My foster mother, Shirley, taught me how to enunciate and speak proper English. My lead attacker grabbed my purse and snatched it open, dropping my tamales to the ground. When he didn't see any money inside, he flung it back at me. My purse hit me in the breast and almost knocked the wind out of me. I winced in pain as he growled in a grimace of disgust. We don't believe you. They began to speak in Spanish among themselves. Fortunately, language was no barrier for me since my current roommate and former foster sister of 8 years, Chica, a Latina, taught me Spanish. Plus, my late father, who was part Spanish, although he was black and came from Belize, only spoke to me in Spanish when I was a little girl. Even when my attackers were kibitzing among themselves in their native tongue, I understood them clearly. Let's go check her car. Go ahead. I spoke back in Spanish and tried to front like I wasn't afraid of anything. At 18, I'd already seen it all. They followed me to my hoopty, which unfortunately was the only car parked in the lot. Yeah, Mommy, you sure is fine, the taller one said as he cracked open my car door. I almost hate to rob you. Roberto, shut the F up, the short one snapped. Stupid, don't use my name. Roberto came up out the car and slapped Shorty upside his head, reminding me of the Three Stooges. Meantime, the medium boy stood guard, still holding the gun and looking out for the police, while Roberto scoured my car. Bet be glad this ain't no initiation day, Shorty mumbled. I guess he was embarrassed that Roberto had slapped him upside his head. For a split second, I almost considered giving up my secret hiding stash. I understood what initiation meant, from what I knew personally and from what I heard on the streets. My oldest brother, ma'am, had outed more people since he'd been 10 than I dared to even guess. My mother, Vanita, was an OG who had been doing time for murder since I was 9 years old, and I vaguely recall witnessing a few drive-bys from when I was young. If I hadn't been raised the second half of my life in a Baldwin Hills foster home, I probably would have been a second-generation Crip myself, and perhaps money would have been no object, because I would have been making that paper. But as a working stiff, broke as I stayed, no way was I parting with my only and last hard-earned $200, plus the tips I earned as a waitress. Okay, I'm going to skip down. We should rape you, Roberto said. Suddenly, a shift in the current of their intentions flashed as their eyes beamed hard with lust. Yeah, let's pull a train on her essay, Shorty jumped in. I never took my eyes off the burner. I had to think fast. Should I give up the money? No. I decided I needed my little hard-earned money. I didn't know where my bravado came from, but I did know my younger brother, Diggity, age 10, and my 9-year-old baby sister, Righteous, as we call Righteousness, who was born while my mother was in prison, were depending on me to come visit them in their different foster homes over the upcoming weekend. They always look for gifts. Speaking in the broken Spanish I learned from my father, I challenged, go ahead, Poppy, knock yourself out. The shorter one's neck craned around suspiciously. What did you say? You serious? Yeah, which one first? I slid my hands down in a sexy, provocative manner between my long, sinewy legs that showed through my polyester uniform. Although I was thin at 5'9", I was shapely. Come on and get it. Give it to me. Hey, I ain't got all day. Okay, I'm going to end there.
All right. Yeah, no, I wanted to ask you, you know, with writing a series, especially, let alone just one book about gang life and, you know, the things that that entail gang life. I mean, you have to have a pretty high degree of accuracy, because some people who are going to be reading it may have gang affiliation, or you know, they may know somebody in gangs or whatever. So, I mean, what did you do to gain your gang knowledge? You know, was it just research? I mean, you know, were you part of a gang? Where did you get your gang knowledge that you were able to apply to your books?
Well, research, people who were in gangs, and then they have Made in America, this Crips and Bloods documentary on the internet. I researched that, and just I talked to different people who were in gangs, and then from my memories, because I was working during the L.A. riots, so that's why I opened it at that scene.
Okay.
But she meets Romero at that scene. He comes to her rescue, so that's how their lives come together.
Okay. Well, for anybody just tuning in, you're on the Artists First World Radio Network, and you're listening to the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. I guess your host is normally Maxine Thompson, but I guess I'm her host for her today. I'm interviewing the lovely Maxine Thompson, talking about her book, L.A. Blues, soon to be a series, right, Maxine?
Yes, I've finished book two, and I'm starting book three.
All right, cool. Well, if you have any questions, listeners, just go ahead and shoot an email to dj@artistfirst.com, and I'll be sure to get them read. We're going to go ahead and take a break real quick, though. We'll be back after in just a few minutes.
Welcome back, everybody. You are on the Artists First World Radio Network. I'm your host, Corey King, on the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. This is the Dr. Maxine Thompson Hour, and we are interviewing Dr. Maxine Thompson about her series, L.A. Blues. Maxine, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, cool. Before we went to the break, Maxine read us an excerpt from L.A. Blues, and we had asked her some questions about gangs, gang life. We were just getting the lowdown on gangs and how it how it related to her book. But our next question here is, do you think becoming a police officer was a good choice for Z? And for anybody just tuning in, Z is the main character, right, Maxine, of L.A. Blues?
Yes, he's the protagonist.
Okay.
You know what? Looking at her life and it was a good thing because she learned to shoot when she was about 7, 8 years old. Her brother taught her how to handle a gun because he later became a kingpin and big time in the Crips. But and he taught her when he was a year older, so he was maybe 9 and she was 8. And so she was really good. Far as the street, she had the street knowledge. She could get information out of people, and that later plays into her being a private investigator. But it was a bad thing because it brought up all these demons, that she had from her childhood, which you find about when you read the book, the reason that they went into foster care. You know, people live on the edge. Sometimes it's so crazy, you don't even want to. I've heard so many crazy stories. You asked me about the credibility. I gave the book to a business owner who was in touch with this gang, former gang leader who had a group, I guess nonprofit group, for helping people get out of gangs. And he when I saw him again, he said it didn't happen like that, because there are some facts in here. I think it was a girl that was killed in Harbor City, and it was one that was really highly publicized. She was 14 years old, and she was not gang affiliated, but because she was in a Latino area. And so there were a lot of things. Oh, it didn't happen like that. It didn't happen. I said, well, this is fiction. So, the gang members saying it didn't happen like that. It doesn't happen like this. But as I said, I actually interviewed a girl who had been in the gang from the time she was about 14 to she died recently. But so from her, and that's when I started researching, finding out there were a lot of women, female gang members, and they could be just as treacherous.
Right, and especially like you said, we've over the years we've evolved to the use of firearms and weapons. So even kids that are 10 years old could, if it was 1v1 versus a buff 38-year-old dude, if he had a gun, he could end it. So that's Well, okay, let's move on to the next question. Do you think the warring factions between the Los Angeles Black and the Latino gangs were drug-related or turf-related?
I really think it was both. Each group had their own little areas, and they were trying to protect, and then they were trying to protect their financial interests. So that's where a lot of the war, I think the gangs got more treacherous once the drugs, got factored into the whole mix. The gangs, from the different history and the studies I've done on, they weren't as bad as they got once drugs became involved, because you're not supposed to sell drugs in somebody else's territory. You're not supposed to go into something. If this is your corner, nobody else is supposed to sell on your corner. So that's where it gets messy.
Okay. When Z became an alcoholic, given her childhood background and the trauma of getting shot, did this make her weak?
There's a line in the story where Z is looking at herself, and she was thinking how she used to see the drunks in the park, and she would say, oh, how did they get like that? Ooh, how did they become alcoholics? Oh, they must have been weak, she said. But she said, now I understand how they got like that. Life kicked them in their ASS. That's how they got like that. You can go through so much. I've seen people become alcoholics or drug addicts after they lose a family member, or when it's just so many traumas, and when you come from a life like, just to give you some example of what happens a lot in Black families, between January 30th and December 30th and January 10th of 2012, and on my husband's side, we buried two 21-year-olds. One was in a tragic car accident, but the other one was murdered. He was shot 6 times, but did nobody see it? Now, that's in Detroit. And on his obituary, he's wearing a rest in peace for one of his friends. So, I'm not just talking about L.A. I'm from Detroit. And I worked as a social worker in Detroit, and I worked as one here. And thank goodness I wasn't as aware of the gangs, even though they were there. I wasn't as afraid. when I look back, but I'm afraid now that I'm older, so I say it's a good thing that I didn't know what I was up against, because I would go out at 2 and 3 in the morning on cases and walk right through gang territory and talk to them and, hey, y'all know where this place is? And they show me the place.
Wow.
Never was, but I think that's because they always say gay, recognized game. I grew up in the inner city of Detroit, so I wasn't afraid. I just didn't have that type of fear, and they sensed it. And so that was a good thing, but I look back, I say, it's really dangerous. And they have so many gang territories now. Now, it's not so bad for people that are not in the gangs, but still people get shot that are the innocent bystanders. They call that collateral damage, you know, sometimes. So you have to really be aware of the gang system in L.A. when you're in L.A.
Right. Now, I mean, living in the area, you said, you know, you were pretty comfortable with it because you had grown up with it and you thought nothing of it. But, I mean, do you think for the average person who, you know, they find a good deal on a house, but it's in this, you know, kind of bad area. I mean, is it unsettling? I mean, it seems like kind of a, I mean, I'd be bothered by it if I couldn't go out, you know, at night to go on a walk because I would, you know, I was afraid of getting shot. Was it unsettling ever for you being in these kind of areas, you know, growing up, living, you know, in gang territory?
Well, see, I grew up in Detroit where the gangs they had back then, they were fighting with their fists, so it wasn't that bad. And now Detroit is really bad. I mean, it's like the Wild Wild West with the drugs and the different things. Anytime somebody shoots you 6 times in the chest, that's an execution. They meant they wanted you dead.
Yeah.
And so glad that I moved away from Detroit 30 years ago, and the gangs here in L.A. are really, you know, they've just been around for 30, 40 years, and they went from just being gangs that were like little, they couldn't get in the Boy Scouts, they couldn't get in the Girl Scouts back in the 50s. I mean, this is how it's explained on Made in America, the documentary. And so they just really just fought, and they would have fist fights with other people, but that was it. But once they started shooting, that's when it really got bad. And, you know, there's been all types of evidence that the government allowed a lot of these machine guns and different guns into the Compton and Watts areas where it really got bad. And then the L.A. 1992 riots, which is where I opened my book, that was an explosion of all the unmet needs of people, you know, because when you're in a community such as L.A., where you can see the haves, it's very in your face that those people there have and I don't have. So you're going to want the same things that the beautiful people have, and you will do it by any means necessary.
Well, it sounds like, you know, gangs are always portrayed as pretty relentless groups of people. Obviously, I mean, if you're, you know, getting shot in the chest 6 times, you know, like you said, they want you dead. But, like, you know, were they ever, you know, like you were, since you were a girl growing up in these areas, were they ever, since you were a girl, I mean, did they treat you differently as far as, like, well, I guess you said you never got bothered with, but do gangs treat, like, you know, the average girl differently? Because I assume they're primarily guys, but you said there were some female gang members. But, I mean, do they respect, you know, the never hit a woman or whatever? Or is it kind of just, you know, I don't care, you're in my territory, that's it, and you're going down?
Well, you know, the girls that, now the one I interviewed, and she asked her, did she get sexed into the group or did she get beat into the group? And she said, well, she fought, and she didn't fight that long, but I guess she fought so hard, they say, you in. And so it's just really, for the girls, I think they become, they're still more the girlfriend of the guys, and they're not the main people, but they have their own little crew, and they do their little things, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, I was just curious. Okay, well, let's get more story specific here, or L.A. Blue specific. Do you think Shirley was a good foster mother? Why or why not?
Oh, I felt she was a very good foster mother. She ended up helping Z through her alcohol problem and, you know, helping her through her detox, which is how she was able to turn around and become a private investigator, which she can be for the next to write. And then she helped Chica, who was Z's foster sister. When Chica had gotten drug out and had five children, she took the kids in and raised them as her grandchildren. You know, she adopted two, and then she was the foster mother for two. I mean, for the other three. So, yes, I think she was a good foster mother, and I've seen foster mothers like this. I've seen them. You know, I've read a lot of books that I edited, and all the foster parents were really rotten, but I've seen some good foster parents, so I said, you know, I'd like to have a story where they show the good foster parents that weren't just in it for the money, who did right. become like real parents and who filled in the gap for uh-huh. the missing parents.
Okay. Well, do you think Shirley was a good, or do you think Chica and her fiance Riley, both being former substance abusers, have a chance at a happy life in L.A. Blues?
Well, that's to be seen. That's to be seen. You know, when people, now, Riley, he had been in Silicon Valley, I believe, and he had been over a computer company, and just to show that it drugs can take down anybody from whatever walk of life. And Chica, you know, she had gotten on them young, and so she's turning her life around, and she, at the end of the book, she becomes a bounty hunter. So you just never know. People can rebuild. Being an optimist, I like to feel that you can change your life no matter what you've gone through, what you've been through. With God's help, you can turn your life around. So I'm hoping they have a happy life.
All right. I mean, is that something we have to look forward to in the next coming book?
They're going to be kind of cameo appearance in the next book, but hopefully she'll have a bigger role in book three.
All right, cool. We'll be looking forward to it. How have gangs impacted communities in larger inner cities?
Well, we've covered a lot of that, and but mainly by people not feeling safe in their own home, people not feeling that their children can go out and play and be safe. It's just had a very detrimental effect all across the United States. So we really, you know, have to address this issue one day. I don't know if we'll ever solve it, but that's something that we need to solve.
Do you think, because we touched earlier about how gangs are these organized, a lot of times large groups of people, and we said that they're growing, and, you know, we're saying it's being influenced by pop culture, which is growing. Do you think it ever could be a very, I mean, it is a serious problem now, but do you think it could ever, like, I mean, eventually one day down the road, you know, overtake society? Do you think, you know, it could just be all be ran by gangs and be territorial and, you know, kind of like civil war, you know, just nonstop. And there's nothing like the police or anything could do about it. Do you think it ever get that bad?
It's almost that bad now.
Yeah.
You know, they don't do anything about it. It's an announcement every week. Somebody got killed. Don't even announce it too much anymore in the news. It's
right.
Like these lives don't count anymore. And it's like this is a civil war going on right within the inner cities.
That's unfortunate.
Yes. But, well, we're coming up on the top of the hour. I have a bad cold, so I thank you so much, Corey, for interviewing me and discussing my book. And L.A. Blues is available nationwide. You can get it on Amazon. You can order it even from my website at MaxineThompsonBooks.com. So please go out and get a copy and be looking for L.A. Blues 2 when it comes out in about 3 months.
All right. Thank you very much, Maxine. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
All right. Thank you so much for interviewing me, Corey. Have a good evening.
You too. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.